This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. If I had asked you a month ago to name the president of Ukraine, you might have been just as stumped as me. Same if I had asked you to explain the military relationship between Ukraine and the U.S., or if I wanted to know what line of business Hunter Biden was in. The impeachment inquiry into President Trump has been highly political from the beginning, led by House Democrats who say things have finally gone too far to not act. Republicans have called it an illegitimate, unconstitutional attempt to override the 2016 election. But step all the way back from the politics, and you'll see that this is about way more than Donald Trump versus Nancy Pelosi. This is about national security, international security, really, and a nation that's been a hotspot for quite some time. In this hour, we'll answer your questions about Ukraine, about the troubling phone call, and what Ukrainians are dealing with now. And we want to take all your questions, including on just the basics of the country and what's going on there. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us to answer your questions is Nina Jankowicz, a global fellow at the Wilson Center, whose research focuses on Central and Eastern Europe. She's also the author of How to Lose the Information War: Russia, Fake News, and the Future of Conflict. Nina, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Also with us is David Herzenhorn, the chief Brussels correspondent for Politico. He covered the war in Ukraine, including the annexation of Crimea. David, welcome.
Great to be with you.
Before we talk about how Ukraine got involved in all this, could you just bring us up to speed on the impeachment inquiry? Where do things stand right now? Hey there, David. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Oh, you're talking to me in here in Brussels. Sure. Well, from our perspective here, obviously, we see congressional Democrats pushing ahead with the effort to understand exactly what it was that President Trump was talking about in his phone call with the president of Ukraine back in July. The White House is decided that it will not cooperate, setting up what could end up being a constitutional crisis. Because, of course, Congress, under Article 1 of the Constitution, has every right to be a check and balance on the presidency. If, in fact, the White House doesn't cooperate, doesn't allow witnesses to come forward, which has been the case so far, we've seen Congress now trying to subpoena the U.S. ambassador to the EU, for example, Gordon Sondland, who was supposed to testify yesterday. But if, in fact, the White House does not cooperate, Congress could then come forward with yet another impeachment charge, essentially accusing the president of obstructing Congress, the proper working of Congress. It could be quite a standoff if, in fact, the White House and Congress can't come to some sort of agreement on how this will proceed.
Nina, it has since been reported that the president reached out to a number of other countries asking for favors or involvement in various things. But why Ukraine? Tell us a bit about the U.S.'s relationship with Ukraine.
Well, I think the U.S. relationship with Ukraine is a pretty unique relationship right now. If you look at the military aid that President Trump's administration gave to Ukraine, about $400 million, that amounts to 5% of the Ukrainian military budget. Not only that, we provide a lot of rhetorical support for Ukraine, which has been, as a reminder to listeners who may have forgotten, in a hot war with Russia for the past 5 years. Without the United States standing up for Ukraine, and you know, shoring up support among allies in Europe, Ukraine might be in a very different place today. And so that's why these requests for favors or pressure that the president is putting on Ukraine is very different to what he's asked of other allies.
I do want to talk more about that hot war in just a minute, and I want to get to some of our audience's questions. But before we go any further, by the way, David, this is going to come up, so we might as well knock it out early. Is it Ukraine or the Ukraine? And why?
It depends on what language you're speaking, but in English, it's Ukraine, and the Ukrainians are very sensitive about this because back when Ukraine was a republic of the Soviet Union, it was referred to in Russian as the Ukraine. And there's a habit that a lot of folks have who remember those Cold War days. The president of the United States sometimes does this, saying the Ukraine, and Ukrainians, in fact, take quite a bit of offense to that. It is an issue that not only involves the name of the country, but even just recently, this is important for us who work as journalists writing about Ukraine, the Associated Press, which maintains the main style guide, just recently changed the spelling of the capital Kiev, which had always been K-I-E-V in English. That's actually a Russian transliteration, and it's now adopted what the Ukrainians prefer, which is their transliteration of their capital city, K-Y-I-V. So these are very sensitive topics. We should get it out of the way. It is Ukraine.
Ukraine, not the Ukraine. Right. Let's get into a little bit more about this impeachment inquiry, Nina. We got lots of questions about the nitty-gritty of it, including this voicemail from a listener who's confused about what exactly it is that former Vice President Joe Biden is actually being accused of. Here's what Anne left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Anne. I'm calling from the Chicago area. Can you give a background explanation of exactly what it is that Trump is accusing Biden and his son of having done that is so controversial in layman's terms, as well as was there actually an issue, you know, a crime or anything done inappropriate?
Very good question, Anne. Nina, what would you say?
Sure. So I'll start with the second question. There is no evidence that Vice President Joe Biden or his son did anything wrong or against the law. What President Trump has accused Joe Biden of doing is withholding a loan guarantee from former President Petro Poroshenko in exchange for legal protection of his son, Hunter Biden, who had been sitting on the board of a Ukrainian gas company that at one point had been investigated by Ukraine's prosecutor general. What's important to know is that Joe Biden essentially said to Petro Poroshenko, this prosecutor general that you have is corrupt. And if you'd like to have access to this loan guarantee, you know, you're going to have to get rid of him. And this was the international community's opinion about this prosecutor general, Viktor Shokin. If you talk to many, many anti-corruption activists in Ukraine, or even just normal Ukrainian citizens, they will tell you that he was not an anti-corruption crusader. He was actually standing in the way of many of these corruption investigations, including the one into the company where Hunter Biden sat on the board. So by asking for this prosecutor general to be fired, Biden wasn't protecting his son. He was actually inviting more investigation into his son.
Nina, explain this loan guarantee. What was the loan guarantee for?
Sure. So this is an international loan guarantee for about $1 billion. And this was in the post-Maidan era. So your listeners may remember about 5 years ago in Ukraine, there was a popular protest movement on what is known as the Maidan, the square in central Kiev and across the country, where for nights on end, people came out in favor of Euro integration, integration with NATO after the former president, Viktor Yanukovych, had kind of reneged on those promises and decided to turn towards Russia. Those protests got violent. They were followed by the illegal annexation of Crimea and the invasion of Ukraine's eastern territories, the Donbas. And Ukraine needed some support from the international community in order to see the reforms, including legal reforms and economic reforms, energy independence in particular, forward. And these loan guarantees are a way that the international community can show their support for a developing democracy. And they often come with preconditions about what sorts of reforms need to take place. And anti-corruption in Ukraine is a huge area. Ukraine had a big hole to dig itself out of over the last 30 years, and it's made a lot of progress in that area. But in order to have access to those funds, they need to achieve certain goals. And that is still the case today.
And just to be clear, Nina, is Ukraine a member of NATO?
No, Ukraine is not a member of NATO, nor is it a member of the European Union.
Gotcha. Now, David, the Energy Secretary Rick Perry has also been very focused on Ukraine. Back during the current president's inauguration, President Zelensky's inauguration in May, he suggested the names of Americans to oversee Ukraine's state-owned gas company. Perry had begun that effort months earlier under the previous Ukrainian president. What's this about? Why is the U.S. so interested business-wise in Ukraine, particularly the energy industry?
Well, Joshua, this is a really big question, and it comes from the entire framework of post-Soviet politics, where Ukraine is in this crucial spot, seen by Russia and Russia's President Vladimir Putin as part of the Russian sphere of influence. And one main reason for that is because of an important pipeline that runs under Ukraine, carrying gas from Gazprom, the Russian state-controlled energy company, to all of Europe. And over the course of time, we have seen when disputes have come up where Russia has strategically turned off the tap. That's happened sometimes in winter making clear that Europe will go quite cold if not for Russia's cooperation and Ukraine paying the prices that Russia wants to pay for gas. Ukraine also gets paid to transport that gas. So gas is basically a theme in every aspect of Ukrainian politics. But this is also a vestige of Cold War politics and the balance of great powers between Russia and the United States. Part of the reforms that Nina was starting to talk about, once Viktor Yanukovych, the former president, had fled after the Maidan Revolution, and here we need a little bit of background for your listeners about why this revolution came about. The president of Ukraine had promised to lead his country westward towards Europe, towards the European Union, by signing an association agreement and a big trade deal with the EU. When the time came to actually put his name on paper, he backed out, broke that promise, partly because Russia was offering financial help that Ukraine desperately needed at the time.
Right.
And that tug of war is what's gotten us here to this point, where you see the United States now encouraging these reforms, the post-Yanukovych reforms, and that includes taking a big state-controlled gas company like Naftogaz in Ukraine and turning it into a real private business with outside expertise. And that's the role that Rick Perry and others had, naming and recommending outside directors who can come in and help make this a real company.
We'll continue in just a moment with David Herzenhorn of Politico and Nina Jankowicz of the Wilson Center. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're answering your questions about Ukraine with Nina Jankowicz, a global fellow at the Wilson Center, and David Herzenhorn, chief Brussels correspondent for Politico. We welcome any of your questions about Ukraine, its role in the impeachment inquiry. We also love to hear from you if you are from Ukraine, if you have family there, if you have business interests there. What do you wish more people understood about that country? Are there any common misconceptions that you find yourself debunking on a regular basis? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. There's one more voice I want to add to the conversation, but first let me play a clip from a joint press conference that President Trump had 2 weeks ago with Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine. He explained that interfering with U.S. elections was not on his list of priorities. Here's a clip from that press conference.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be involved to democratic, open elections of USA. My priority is to stop the war on Donbass and to get back our territories.
That was President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine at a joint press conference with President Trump 2 weeks ago. Nina, what can you tell us about President Zelensky and his presidency thus far, particularly in the context of those comments he made where he says, I don't want to be involved in the elections. My priority is to stop the war.
Right. So Zelensky is in a really interesting and difficult, I think, position. I think probably a lot of people read the transcript and rolled their eyes at his references to draining the swamp or staying at Trump Hotel. But he has a really difficult line to walk here, a thin line, because Ukraine enjoys bipartisan support on Capitol Hill. It's one of the few things that men can agree about. And he doesn't want to upset anyone. He wants to build a bridge with President Trump, who he probably feels some kinship with as an entertainer, although it must be said Zelensky is a much more adept communicator and businessman in general. But he was trying to make a friend, trying to shore up support there, and now he's finding himself in the awkward position of having his private remarks made public and potentially, you know, creating some enemies not only in the Democratic Party but among allies in Europe. So he's in a really difficult spot, and I think his approach of silence right now is probably the only choice that he has.
And David, before we keep going, President Zelensky's got an interesting background. He was a comedian before he was president, right?
He was playing the president on a TV show before he was elected the president. That's right.
The looking glass we've gone through is just a little too thick to see the edges. So he played president and then he became president. Did people think that was weird at all, or was that part of his appeal?
Of course, it was part of his appeal, but we have a reality TV personality as president of the United States. This is, you know, electoral politics in the 21st century. You know, everything is possible. So Ukrainians, for all the reasons Nina's talking about, were looking for a fresh start. They want to end this war. They've lost a big chunk of their country, Crimea, which Russia invaded and annexed, just took. The war has been going on in the east now for 5 years. And Zelensky offered this kind of non-traditional figure, a non-politician who could come in and was promising to do his best. And one of the most powerful lines in his inaugural speech back in May was when he told Ukrainians, look, you know, for all these years, I've been working very hard to make you laugh. For the next 5 years, that's his term, I'm going to do my best not to make you cry, because Ukrainians have felt so let down by their politicians in the roughly quarter century since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
David, I'm glad you mentioned the war. That's a good segue to bring another voice into our conversation. Joining us from Harvard University is Serhii Plokhii, professor of Ukrainian history and director of the Ukrainian Research Institute. Professor, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Can you walk us all the way back to the beginning with this war? Can you explain to us how did it start?
Well, the beginnings are really back in 1991 when Ukraine declared independence and the Soviet Union was dissolved really 1 week after the Ukrainian referendum. And U.S. recognized Ukraine as an independent country, and Russia's position toward Ukraine and other post-Soviet republics is that their sovereignty is really not full and it's conditional. The war began in 2014 with the Russian annexation of the Crimea, something that was already mentioned here, and then followed with the so-called hybrid warfare in eastern part of Ukraine, in Donbas. And I started with 1991, and it was back then that for the first time the spokesman for the Russian president, it was Boris Yeltsin, back in 1991, made a claim for those particular territories. So basically that was somewhere on the back burner of Russian foreign policy for a long period of time.
Now, when Ukraine declared independence, is that what touched off the dissolution of the Soviet Union?
Well, after that, Ukraine was the second largest republic in the Soviet Union after Russia. And after Ukrainians decided to go independent, Russia was not interested anymore in the continuation of the Soviet Union project. And within 1 week, the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus met together and decided to dissolve the Soviet Union.
What is it about Crimea, Professor, that Russia is so very interested in?
Well, in 2014, we are talking about the second Russian annexation of the Crimea. The first,
Professor,
one...
I'm sorry, I hate to interrupt you. I should back up one step. Let me make that a little smaller. What is Crimea? Tell us about that region, and then if you would just explain why Russia is so interested in it.
Well, the most important thing about the Crimea is that it is a peninsula, and peninsulas traditionally depend on the mainland in terms of communications, in terms of resources, and so on and so forth. And in that particular case, mainland is Ukraine. So that was the reason why that peninsula in the middle of the Black Sea was transferred from Russia to Ukraine back in 1954. What happened there that it was and continues legally to be the only region of Ukraine where ethnic Russians constitute the majority. And that was a big issue in the Russian politics since 1991. And there is also a strategic importance of the peninsula because of its location, of its navy bases and strategic location in the Black Sea.
So you've got Ukraine that declares its independence in 1991. The Soviet Union falls apart. And then you've got Crimea, this peninsula in the south of Ukraine. And if you're looking at – if Ukraine was a clock, basically Crimea would be like at 6 p.m. It's where the Black Sea is, at the southern part of Ukraine. And so – but Crimea is largely ethnically Russian, and so Russia sees that as kind of a way – I guess in its own view to legitimize attacking Crimea to re-annex it?
Well, that's certainly one line that is pushed and promoted. And after the really military takeover of the peninsula, the referendum was organized on the peninsula. the one that happened without presence of international observers, so Ukrainian observers, and which was, in the opinion of the majority of the scholars and watchers of the region, falsified. That is the quote-unquote legal foundations for the annexation. There is one more factor that is often forgotten, and that's the fact that Crimea has been traditionally a homeland for the Crimean Tatars, who were forcefully resettled by Joseph Stalin back in 1944 before the Yalta Conference that had Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin really deciding what would happen with the world after the end of World War II. So the Crimean Tatars were coming back after Ukraine declared its independence, and now this is actually a very big unresolved issue among all other unresolved issues in the Crimea, and you have quite a few of Crimean Tatars, the political emigres in mainland Ukraine, being quite active in Ukrainian politics and certainly pushing for Crimea as supporting the struggle for the return of the peninsula to Ukraine.
David Herzenhorn, you were in Kiev during the revolution, during the annexation of Crimea. What do you remember from that time? What was that like?
Well, I was actually in Crimea when what were then called the polite little green men showed up. These were Russian forces who deployed across Crimea. And I actually watched as they took the license plates off of Russian military vehicles and then left them unmarked in what was then a sort of disinformation effort by the Kremlin to suggest that it wasn't in fact a full-on Russian invasion, which it was. It wasn't a hugely violent conflict. There was just a little bit of shooting, obviously overwhelming force on the Russian side. But this was part of this unfolding tug of war over Ukraine between the West and Russia. Russia perceives, again, this as its sphere of influence. And Vladimir Putin was not about to let the president of Ukraine be toppled essentially by public democratic protests by the citizens who were genuinely outraged at that time at the broken promise from their president. But Putin was not going to stand for this, and certainly he was going to move to secure Russia's strategic interest, having that Navy base on the Black Sea, and quickly enacted held a referendum where the public voted. And on this part, we can say Crimea is a Russian-speaking territory. People felt closer to Russia, and I believe a majority of the folks there wanted to be part of Russia. This is part of the tangled politics of the post-Soviet Union. Again, there's no way you can call that a free and fair election when there are tanks in the streets. But in fact, if you'd asked people at that time, would they prefer to be part of Russia or Ukraine, they would have said Russia, largely because of this very complicated history.
We're speaking to David Herzenhorn of Politico, Nina Jankowicz of the Wilson Center, and Harvard professor Serhii Plokey. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Nina, this has been described by some, I think also particularly by Russia, as a civil war. Is that what this is? Is this a civil war, or is that just kind of a propaganda? Is that a spin on this?
There are some scholars that would argue that it is a civil war, but as I outlined in a piece that I wrote for the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago, I don't think that we can call it a civil war because, as David just explained, there are Russian regular troops who were responsible for the annexation of Crimea, the illegal annexation of Crimea, and we have lots of evidence that Russian regular forces and Russian military equipment, not to mention Russian funds and other means of support, are propping up the so-called separatist regimes in the Donbass. And I would not call that a civil war because without Russia's participation in that war would not be going on. It would have not have claimed 13,000 lives over 5 years. And I'd just like to add one thing. You know, I don't disagree at all with David's characterization of the events of 2014, although I do think it's important that we bring back the agency of the Ukrainian people in this entire saga. David described it as a tug of war, but it's, people, this is about self-determination, and many many Ukrainians are, I think, in a way that most Americans wouldn't understand, willing to go out and die for their country and for their rights to self-determination in a way that we have not been for a long time. These are people who are on the front lines of defending democracy right now. And this is why this current scandal makes it even more kind of ridiculous that we would be asking Ukrainians to trade that away.
Interesting you bring that up, Nina, because that speaks exactly to some of the comments we've gotten from people who have relatives in Ukraine. Here is mm-hmm. what Nicole left in our inbox.
Hi, my name is Nicole. I'm calling from Michigan. I am originally from Russia. I do have quite a lot of family in Ukraine. What's happening right now is pretty upsetting, appalling. It's really hard to find the word for it. Ukraine desperately needs the help of the Western world, and what Trump is doing, withholding help, financial help, to fight off the Russian invasion, it's just simply upsetting. Ukraine is a small country. It's doing all they can to withstand this Russian aggression, and it's very upsetting to see how current administration is dealing with this.
Nicole, I appreciate you sharing your story. Thanks very much. And David, a few days ago, you tweeted, quote, "Most Americans have no idea the extent to which Ukrainians idealized U.S.-style democracy and how deeply crushing it is for them to watch recent events," unquote. Sounds like you and Nicole are kind of echoing the same thought.
Well, there's no question, just following up on Nina's point and underscoring how much she and I agree based on my experience during that Maidan revolution.
All right, we're going to work on getting our connection back to David. But Nina, if you are there, I wonder if we could shift a little bit, since we're going to lose you in just a second, from the current democratic struggles in Ukraine to the perception of Ukraine. It has been called a corrupt country in the past by a number of political figures, Joe Biden, Donald Trump. How do you view it? Is Ukraine corrupt?
Ukraine definitely has a problem with corruption. As I mentioned before, you know, it had a big hole to dig itself out of, not only at the end of the Soviet era, but during its early political transition, that corruption became even more endemic. However, I will say that Ukraine has made a ton of progress in the past 5 years, both under the Poroshenko administration and now under the Zelensky administration. All public officials in Ukraine have to file an electronic declaration of their assets that the public can look at. I would love to see that in the United States. That's just one example of the reforms that have been made. But, you know, I'd say it has problems with corruption. It is Zelensky and his administration are committed to fighting them. And you know what? The Ukrainians are as well. And if they don't see enough progress from the Zelensky administration, they'll be out in the streets just like they have been before, because that's the resiliency of the Ukrainian people that I saw when I lived there.
We're going to get to some more questions from our listeners, but before we have to let you go, Nina, what are you keeping an eye out for in the next few weeks and months as it relates to what's happening in Ukraine, either as it relates to Ukraine and Russia or Ukraine and the U.S.?
Well, I hope that Russia doesn't see this as an opening. You know, we've been vacillating in our support. We, the United States, have been vacillating in our support. There is daylight between what the Trump administration does and what comes out of the White House, and that worries me. I think it presents an opening for the Russian Federation, and I hope I'm wrong. But one thing that does encourage me, again, is that bipartisan support for Ukraine on Capitol Hill, and I'll be watching to see how this impeachment inquiry does or does not affect that.
And briefly, when you said there's daylight between what the administration says and does, where is that daylight brightest before we let you go?
Well, again, for 3 years so far, we've heard the Trump administration say that no president has been stronger on Russia. And we've heard President Trump say, citing that military aid as one of the reasons for his strength on countering Russia. Now we know that has been, used as a political tool, or we assume it has been. At any rate, that shouldn't be held up regardless of the reasoning.
All right, that's Nina Jankowicz, a global fellow at the Wilson Center and author of How to Lose an Information War. We'll continue momentarily with David Herzenhorn of Politico and Serhii Plokhi, director of the Ukrainian Research Institute at Harvard. And we'll get to some more of your questions and thoughts as well. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with David Herzenhorn of Politico and Harvard professor Serhii Plokhii. Still time to get in some of your questions and thoughts. 1A at WAMU.org. David, let's back up to the impeachment inquiry and one of the people who is now a prominent character in that story. Chris asked, please explain the role of the ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, in Ukraine, especially since Ukraine is not in the EU. Why is he involved with Ukraine, and who gave him instruction to develop this relationship? David?
Well, Gordon Sondland has described this himself, being part of a small group of officials that they called themselves the Three Amigos. That was Sondland, Kurt Volker, who was the U.S. Special Representative for helping to mediate the Ukraine conflict, and the Energy Secretary, Rick Perry. Now, the listener is exactly right. Gordon Sondland is ambassador to the EU. But in fact, the ambassador in the EU touches on many, many issues. In Sondland's case, the important one was a gas issue. Of course, this is Ukraine. And I wrote about this recently in Politico. The U.S. and the EU are in a trade dispute because Donald Trump is causing trade disputes all around the world. And part of a temporary truce that was created there was a decision to sell more American liquefied natural gas to the EU. Donald Trump was very excited about this, and Sondland was a part of that decision. Trump also is very angry and opposed to a gas pipeline, another Russian gas pipeline called Nord Stream 2. And lo and behold, Ukraine is a huge opponent of Nord Stream 2 as well. And it seems to me the natural gas issue was the opening for Sondland to get further involved in Ukraine. For Volker, who's a career diplomat, resigned as part of this impeachment process, Sondland was useful because as the ambassador here in Brussels, he was able to build a relationship with the White House directly, especially with Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. And for Volker and others in the State Department, struggling to be on the radar at times with the Oval Office, Sondland was able to do that. So in partnership with Volker and with Rick Perry, you saw Sondland as part of the official delegation to Zelensky's inauguration in May. They were in Kiev on other occasions. And most importantly, they were in Kiev, the capital, the day after that central phone call between Zelensky and Trump that kicked off the impeachment inquiry.
Professor Plokhii, I've heard in terms of the story of Ukraine, between Ukraine and Russia, there are legacy issues between the two. There are cultural issues between the two. In terms of the story between Ukraine and the West, a lot of it has to do with this gas pipeline. A lot of what the U.S. does geopolitically around the world kind of boils down to transaction. It's really about oil. It's really about gas. It's really about energy. Is that what this is for the U.S.? Is this mostly about oil, gas, commodities, energy, or is there something larger to it than that?
Well, oil and gas industry historically is really very closely linked to geopolitics. And it is linked to a degree that it's really very difficult to distinguish where one ends and another starts. And this is certainly the case with Ukraine and the gas pipeline that goes through Ukraine. Ukraine is important for the West and for the United States geopolitically because, again, this is the country that resists current Russian aggression. Where Ukraine goes probably will go certainly the rest of the post-Soviet space. And that's geopolitical importance. And then, of course, there is the issue of the gas pipeline and dependence of Central and Western Europe, historical dependence on Russian gas. What that means is that those countries are open for Russian blackmail. And again, Russia already tried to use gas supplies to Europe through Ukraine a number of times to achieve political goals, stopping them for a while and then letting the gas go again. So again, these things are interconnected.
So, Professor, what's Russia's end game? What does Vladimir Putin want if he could kind of write his ideal outcome with all of this?
Well, Russia tries to reestablish its dominance and control over the post-Soviet space. And when I say post-Soviet space, it's not just Belarus, where there is certainly A lot of activity happening now in terms of making the union between Russia and Belarus more a real union and more allow more Russian control over Belarus. But it's also Ukraine and the Baltic states. So Russia never really fully recognized, as I mentioned earlier, the independence, the complete independence of those countries. And then another big goal that I don't think it's achievable anymore was the creation on that space, not just military, political, but also economic union that could compete with European Union in the West and China in the East.
So it wants to regain its standing as it kind of wants to reconstitute and be a geographical and military superpower by kind of reasserting itself in all these states.
Yes. And if you look at Mr. Putin and people around him, these are people who really were formed in the Soviet Union during the 1970s, where the Soviet Union certainly was the one of two world superpowers, and that's making Russia great again, probably, in the terms of the 1970s. It's one of the goals of the current administration in Kremlin.
Hey, by the way, for those of you who are trying to kind of picture where we're talking about, I know the geography of this gets a little weird. All of the other nations we're talking about are kind of to Moscow, to Russia's west. If you imagine the Baltic Sea at the top, the Black Sea at the bottom, so the Baltic Sea is at the north of this chain, the Black Sea is at the bottom. You start with the three Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, going north to south, then south of Lithuania is Belarus, south of that is Ukraine, and south of Ukraine is the Black Sea. So that's kind of the geography that we're talking about. So Ukraine and Russia share an east-west border, and Ukraine is just north of the Black Sea. Daniel asked, and David, if you could answer this one. Daniel asked, if a Democrat wins the White House, how do you think the relationship between the two countries could go forward? How much harm has been done?
Well, for whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, we would expect some restoration of normal diplomatic ties. Ukraine very much still wants American support, both in the war against Russia and generally in its progress towards becoming a more Western state. And in this case, I think why it's so worrisome to Zelensky and folks in Kiev is the notion that Ukraine and all of its politics just becomes toxic for American politicians, that because of this scandal, because of impeachment, you know, there is an inability to deal with Ukraine on its own terms regarding its own issues. And just to follow up on the geography point that you're making, crucial to understand, Ukraine sits between Russia and Poland, Poland being a member of NATO, Russia being very much in an antagonistic posture towards NATO. And that question of where the border with NATO lies is a big one for Vladimir Putin. When people ask me, what is Putin trying to do in Ukraine? My answer to that is, it's not a question of what Putin wants in Ukraine. He wants Ukraine. And if he can't have Ukraine, he wants a broken Ukraine that the West and NATO can't have either. Now, of course, as Nina was saying, the Ukrainians have their own agency here, and they very much wanted a Western trajectory. And that is where we see now the look to Washington, the look toward Brussels of, you know, hey, what can you do for us? How can you help us get out of this war that's now going on for 5 years?
David, this has got to be a little bit crazy making for Ukrainians to be caught in the middle of all this and still kind of struggling to find its footing.
Well, when the revolution was going on, the Maidan revolution, and the center of Kiev, the capital, was literally on fire for weeks on end. You had thousands of people sleeping on the streets in tents, camped out, protesting. One of the toughest times for me would be when folks would come up to me as an American journalist and say, you know, really, what do Americans think about what's happening in our country? And to answer them, honestly, I had to say, you know, the problem is they don't think about your country at all. And now to see Americans actually thinking about Ukraine, but not thinking about the fact that, again, as we were discussing earlier, these are Ukrainians who may be the only people who have died under an EU flag, died for Western democracy, feeling it's that important. For them now to be thought about, but only in the context of this scandal in Washington, that's got to be, you know, tremendously depressing, you can imagine.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Professor, let's get to a voicemail from a listener who's wondering about a possible agreement between the U.S. and the former Soviet Union that might affect Ukraine's relationship with NATO. Here's what John left in our inbox.
This is John in Cleveland. I have a question about our relationship with the Ukraine. Did we have an agreement with the old Soviet Union that if we did not bother Ukraine and Belarus, the Soviet Union would allow Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania into NATO?
John, thanks for the question. So again, just to get the geography clear, if we don't bother Ukraine and Belarus to its north, then the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, would be allowed into NATO by the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union would not interfere with that. Professor, is that true?
There was never an agreement of that sort, but what was there was the position adopted by the White House back in 1991. Again, it was under President George H.W. Bush, where the United States actually supported the idea of the Soviet Union going on, but without Baltic states. And that was the line that President Bush gave in when he visited Kyiv on August 1st, 1991, where he warned Ukrainians not to go really independent, not to really break the Soviet Union. That speech got a lot of publicity, negative publicity in the U.S. and in the world as Chicken Kyiv speech. So eventually that approach to the Soviet Union and future of the Soviet Union was abandoned as a result of Ukraine's referendum for independence on December 1st, 1991, where more than 90% of Ukrainians voted for independence. After that, the U.S. policy of let the Baltic states go, but the rest of the Soviet Union continue to exist, that policy was dead.
Professor, what do you see for the future of Ukraine in terms of NATO, in terms of the EU? Is it possible, is it likely in your view that Ukraine would be a part of either group in the future?
Ukraine got a promise of becoming a member of NATO in the future. The membership in NATO today is in Ukrainian constitution, which is really very interesting. So Ukraine tries to become both member of the EU and member of NATO. That is one of the reasons why Russia is so unhappy about the situation in Europe, in Eastern Europe in particular, and Ukraine's politics. But I don't see neither one membership or another happening anytime soon. What I would say, though, that for Ukraine to keep having that as a goal, especially when it comes to the European Union, it's extremely important for the cleaning up corruption and really going ahead with reform of energy sector, with the reform of Ukraine's economy. And close military ties with the United States in particular, that's certainly a step also in the direction of eventual joining NATO. But again, I don't see neither one or another happening anytime soon.
David, as we're winding down, I wonder if there's anything in particular, considering that you've covered Ukraine and the various machinations that have gone on with it and Russia for a while. Is there anything in particular that you wish more of us in the U.S. understood about Ukraine? Is there one thing that people constantly get wrong about this entire saga that you wish we would finally get straight?
Well, the most important thing is to understand that Ukraine is, in fact, its own real country with its own real agenda, that it's not some prop in a soap opera that's being played out either in Moscow or in Washington. This is really crucial. And this you hear when Zelensky is talking to Trump. We know the notes of that phone call. It seems that he's being very supplicative to the president, telling the president what he wants to hear. But if you read it carefully, you also understand that he's very much pursuing Ukraine's own national interests, trying to keep the president focused on what Ukraine needs from the United States. You know, talking about agreements, Ukraine would have been one of the world's biggest nuclear powers if not for an agreement after the Soviet Union collapsed to give up all of its nuclear weapons in exchange for what it believed was respect for its territorial sovereignty from Russia and from the West. This Budapest Agreement is something that's cited by Ukrainians all the time as a reason why the West should have been prepared even to go to war to protect its territorial sovereignty, because in fact, Ukraine had contributed to global safety and security by giving up all of the nuclear weapons that were on its territory after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So more than anything, it's to understand, as we started out, it's not the Ukraine, it's Ukraine, it's its own country. In Kyiv, the capital, spelled K-Y-I-V, that folks there have their own views about what their aspirations are for the future, regardless of what Vladimir Putin or Donald Trump may want for their own political future.
David Herzenhorn, chief Brussels correspondent for Politico. David, thanks for talking to us.
Great to be with you.
And Harvard professor Serhiy Plokhy, director of its Ukrainian Research Institute and a professor of Ukrainian history. Thank you, professor.
It was a pleasure.
Remember to send us your stories about how you fared housing-wise in the Great Recession, 855-236-1A1A. This conversation was produced by Haley Blassingame, and special thanks to KMUW for hosting us this week. To learn more about the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.